from the past.
Find McCloud and kill him.
Is all that stands between life and death.
There simply isn't enough energy on the planet to take down the shield without killing us all.
The world is dying, McCloud. The shield has to come down.
Greetings, Islander. You cold?
You got a light?
Let's have some fun.
It sounds like magic.
Well, it is,
kind of.
Christopher Lambert, Sean Connery, Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, whatever it is, wherever you are. My name is Malachi J. Matthews. This is Super Tap Film Club, and I am joined this week by It's a Kind of Magic, Mark.
I'll let you have that one this week, considering what we're watching. Malachi J. Matthews, if that is your real name.
Yes, it is. It totally is my real name. We haven't had you on the show for a couple of weeks. We've been mixing it up.
You have, and I've been enjoying the episodes, listening to other people talking about Tat. It's good stuff.
Yeah, E.K. Wimmer was on talking about some heavy metal horror.
Yeah, I'd like to record with E.K. Wimmer at some point, just so I can say E.K. Wimmer, because it's a good name.
He's got the knowledge when it comes to the VHS-based Tat.
He is also an interesting man. I enjoyed his Americanality.
Well, the thing is, I say this to him on a regular basis, I accidentally learn things from listening to Laser Graves on a weekly basis. So that's not a bad thing, is it?
And I'm sure that he learns about weird-ass British slang and Coronation Street from us.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I did introduce him to Pugwall's Summer.
Pugwall's Summer. I watched that so many times. I popped when you played that at the end of the episode as well.
Yeah.
What was the little girl band called? Was it Marmaloids or something
like that? The Marmaloids, yeah, and they did a rap. The Marmaloid rap. And I'm here to say, it was one of those ones.
Marmaloid.
But I did get a message from one of our listeners, Brent, who was having a go at me for not actually calling the band by their real name on the episode, which is the Orange Organics, and I'm very sorry.
He's right.
I just called them Pugwall's Summer. That, of course, is the name of the show and the era of time with which this musical adventure took place. It was over a summer. Yeah.
Pugwall's Summer. Orange Organics. I hadn't thought about that for about 20 years until I listened into that episode, and it did make me smile.
Fletcher was back with us last week. He was supposed to be here this week, but he's ill. He's not got the COVID, but he's in bed with a cold, so he's not spreading his disease around. It's been a good lad. It's been a good lad during the don't spread the disease around time.
Get well soon, Hollywood Fletch.
But it's a shame that he's not here, because Magic Mark, what film did we watch this week on Super Tap Film Club?
We watched Highlander 2.
Highlander 2 from 1991. Highlander 2, The Quickening. Yeah, well, we all know how much of an absolute banger the first one is. Literally, one of my favourite films. I can watch it to death.
It's magnificent. And also Tat.
But Mark, you'd never seen the first one. You obviously enjoyed the first one. You're overjoyed with the amount of Queen in it. There's a lot of lightning in it. You know, swashbuckling to the max.
Sword fighting.
Yeah, in New York City. So how can you go wrong? What did you think of the second one?
So within the first 10 minutes, it had completely shat on the first film. From a great height, they added some unexplained and shit-ass fucking retcons. And within the first 10 minutes, apparently they're not immortal humans, they're aliens.
Yeah.
Apparently the quickening isn't when you kill all the other immortals, it's some kind of weird-ass alien ritual.
I think you'll find it's a kind of magic, Mark.
Well, quite. And Ramirez and McLeod already knew each other before they met in the first film, even though they hadn't. What a load of cack.
The film starts. Right, as we remember, as we left it last time, Connor McLeod had defeated the evil Kurgan that had been fighting him throughout time. You remember that? He was a right bad lad. Killed him, he won the prize. And the prize in the first film was you get to become mortal and you get to have a wife and be a normal man. And that's what he wanted, so that's what he got. Cut to Highlander 2. We are in August 1999. The ozone layer has gone. The sun is destroying everything on Earth. The last chance for planet Earth, by the way, is Connor McLeod, because he is the science advisor on a giant man-made ozone dome to protect the Earth from the sun, yeah, called The Shield, that they switch on, and they've had 25 years of darkness. 25 years later, McLeod is now an old man. He's aged really, really badly. He's an old man. He says there's no sun, there's no stars, only heat and humidity. Darkness, and the human race is going backwards, by which he means they're reverted to the 1940s by the looks of things.
So I've got some very serious issues with them. I've already mentioned three of them, the fucking retcons, but why, oh why, oh why did they move the wonderful fantasy setting of Highlander and make it rando sci-fi for no good reason?
No idea. Absolutely no idea. It just it makes no sense. Like the world now, the Earth now, within the confines of this film, is in total darkness. Everything is neon, which isn't a bad thing. Everyone dresses like it's the 1940s. Connor McLeod is an old man trapped there. And the street punk sniffing petrol in the street.
Connor McLeod never showed any scientific prowess in the first film. So where's he got all this kind of scientific knowledge from?
Maybe he gained that from the prize at the end when he was like, I can hear everyone in the world. And he just heard one man talk about a shield thing. And he's like, I'll come and help you out with that.
But that's not the quickening, is it? Because the quickening was retconned.
That's true. That is true, yeah.
I've got other fucking issues as well. Where's Queen? There is no Queen.
Well, it was minimum Queen. There is a little bit of Queen in a bit when he puts them on a jukebox. he puts his own theme tune on a jukebox in a bar in a minute.
Also, so you think that the quickening gave him all the knowledge of all the people, but he never does at any point during this film use his thoughts and dreams power. It's not even fucking mentioned.
Inside Connor McLeod's old car, he's got a TV phone and it's flickering and the news comes on and it says, this is the future and the future is like a dirty 50s. Everyone drives old-timey cars. By the way, the Shield is run by an evil business douche who just happens to be the fella from Scrubs.
I want to point out here that this is 2024. So in this reality, the world got over COVID and vaccinations work. As far as I'm concerned, that's proof that is all the proof I need that I'm going to take the vaccine.
Yeah, so we got three more years of light then, basically, Mark. And then we'll be all right for a bit. We can grow some veg in that time. Stockpile it.
Yeah, it's a good idea, that.
Yeah. Connor McLeod goes to the opera, and the opera is being sung by a terribly dubbed lady on the stage. Who's hardly moving her mouth at all.
It really is completely unconvincing.
This causes McLeod to have a flashback. But a flashback to where? The first film? No. His home planet. He gets... He hears Sean Connery. His voice whispers through the ether to him and it says, remember, Highlander. Remember your home. In another galaxy. You were chosen. Remember. And he says, yes, I do remember. And he flashes back to 500 years ago on the planet Zeist, which is a shitty Star Wars style desert planet.
Even the name Zeist, it's just shit, isn't it? It might as well have been fucking Zog.
The planet Zeist is being ruled by an evil man called General Katana, which is very lazy as well, because as we learned before, what does Katana mean?
It's a sword, isn't it?
Yeah, it means sword. Katana is played by Michael Ironside. He's back. The bad lad from Scanners.
Back in the Tat Club. The river, yeah. And all that usual gubbins that you chat.
Well, we haven't mentioned. We don't need to mention that Lambert and Connery have already been in this river because it was with Highlander 1. So, yeah, this is the new Kurgan, as it were, General Katana, played by Michael Ironside. Connery chooses McCloud from a crowd. He says, "Right, people, we're going to go and fight General Katana. And I need, there's a chosen one among you." And he says, "Let him feel," gets out his sword and says, "the quickening." And he points at Connor McCloud and he's like, "Me? Me?" And everyone steps away from him like they do in these sort of scenes in films. He gets up on stage with Sean Connery and they put their fingers in what can only be described as a laser bowl. They take their fingers out of the laser bowl, now powered with lightning, which is flickering between like each other's hands. That's the quickening, mate.
That's not the fucking quickening. That is not the fucking quickening. Oh, this is a different quickening. There can be two quickenings, but that's not the quickening.
Mark, what are you talking about? This is the ancient power of the quickening, and it has joined them as one person now. Yeah? McCloud's first job as leader is to defeat General Katana in battle, which, by the way, he totally fails at. Everyone dies.
You had one job.
Katana, he says, "I want the one they called McCloud, and bring me Ramirez." His henchman says, "The others?" He says, "Kill them all. I want their heads." Because he's evil. He's like the Kurgan. But did you notice his belt is like a championship belt?
I did, yes.
Yeah, it's quite good.
But I just love Michael Ironside. He just seems to be having the best time. He don't care about no continuity bollocks. He's just going to turn up, chew the scenery, and have the best time. And I can respect that.
Yeah, he does. And you genuinely can tell that he's loving this film. They're just like, "Just be evil, Michael." And he's like, "How evil? Go full Ironside."
Yeah, and I think he deserves a love heart.
Yeah, he does. I mean, he's an evil man. It's hard to fill the shoes of the Kurgan, and he's not replaced him, but he's just sat up there next to him now.
I think so.
I tell you how evil he is, Mark. He's got pet eels, and to demonstrate how evil he strangles his own pet eel right in front of Connor McCloud.
It's not a nice thing to do, is it?
Not really, no. I mean, but he's evil. That's it. They've established this now. Ramirez and McCloud are tried for space treason now, Mark. Space treason, yeah? Expelled from the planet Zeist, sent to Earth. Once you are there, you will become immortal. The only way to die is to chop someone's head off. Last man standing. We know the rules. We've been here before. The prize. All that. And besides which, it doesn't matter the first one now, so forget it.
And you wonder whether the Kurgan maybe sided alongside them and he was one of the rebels, or why was he sent to Earth? They don't cover that, though, do they?
No. They don't even mention the Kurgan. And they say, this is where they say the prize, Mark, it isn't just becoming immortal, like they said before in the first one. Now you get a choice. You can stay on Earth, grow old, have a wife, all that stuff, or you can return home to Zeist, champion of Earth. Yeah?
Yeah. That's not what they said in the first one.
Connor McCloud turns around to Ramirez and says, will we be together on Earth? Not at first, but we are joined in a way that can never be broken. Not even by death. When you need me, all you have to do is call my name and I'll always find you. That's the quickening, mate. McCloud says, that sounds like magic. Connery, well, it is. Kinda. Lasers cover our heroes. Next stop, planet Earth. That's the whole bit we didn't even know before the start of Highlander 1. This had all happened before he turned up at Madison Square Garden and fought that old man in the car park.
The guy who wrote original Highlander didn't have any part in writing this. Has he ever gone on record as saying, "I'm fucking livid that some other guy fucked with my lovely, lovely film"?
Well, I think everybody that was involved in this film basically went on record and said... said that, Mark.
Right.
Because it turned out to be an absolute disaster. The version that me and Mark watched, the version that we both owned, isn't available anymore. You can't actually get that version anymore. They've deleted it. They've reinstated... They did a new version, a new director's cut, called the Renegade version, where they actually added in a few more scenes, cut out all of the space nonsense, so it's just like a proper Highlander film.
I did try and get a copy of the Renegade version, but when I looked on eBay, it was £40. And if when I looked on Amazon, it was £45. And I don't have £45.
Not for a copy of Highlander, no.
And the other thing is, the DVD version that you and I both had was clearly a shonky VHS rip with fuck all done to it. Even to the point where I had this massive black border that went around the entire screen. It was ropey as fuck, the picture quality for DVD. And I'm not a... bothered by picture quality per se. I'm half blind, I can't really fucking see the big difference between them. I could see the difference between this, because it was cack.
I've got quite a few DVDs in my collection that are like this. It's like original prints. My copy of The Crow on DVD is the same as this, but I've got it on Blu-ray now, don't worry. McLeod wakes up. The show at the opera is over. This is where we see Christopher Lambert doing some top-notch, top-quality old man acting, Mark. He might as well be calling everyone Sonny. He's like, oh, I'm such an old man.
Yeah, it was a bit over. What am I saying? It's fucking Highlander. Even the original, it was hardly the most intellectual of films, but this was just...
Yeah, it's hard to believe that the same people made this film. But yeah, it's now 2024. Shady special ops type people dressed in black and helmets, they're sneaking in with grappling hooks into the SHIELD facility, past all the futuristic security guards that look like Starship Troopers, but they're totally clueless. They're in, duffing up an office guy with a ponytail, helmets off, and that's the reveal of Louise. She's snuck in to the SHIELD because she knows the shenanigans going on, Mark. She goes and she checks on a screen, downloading information onto some kind of tech. And she's like, what? This says that outside of the dome, the weather is fine. This corporation is keeping the Earth under a dome for this fucking filthy lucre, Mark. That's what they want.
OMG. For me, the ozone layer shield, corrupt company who are running it to make money, blah, blah, blah. As a sci-fi concept goes, that ain't half bad. It's hardly original. It's kind of like you'd maybe see it in a manga or an anime before you'd see it in an American production. It's not a bad little idea. And if it was just that, without the bullshit about the planet Zog, I could be alright with that. I could be alright with that. Even though it's all bullshit, I haven't hated this film so far. There's been...
No.
You know, I quite like the idea of Connor McLeod aging and... kind of becoming a scientist rather than a fighter, and yeah, it's fine, but it's batshit, and it's got more retcons than Doctor Who.
Well, that's what it is, Mark. It's, you know why it's looking good now? It's because you're looking through your tat eye.
Yeah.
I remember being furious when I saw this as a child, and I think I deleted it from my memory. Louise, she's running riot through the SHIELD center, through the futuristic SHIELD building with her Black Ops team. They split up and she manages to escape. Connor McLeod goes to a 1950s bar and he puts on It's a Kind of Magic on the jukebox. Puts his own theme tune on, as it were, on the jukebox. And he says, hey, Jimmy, in his old man voice to the barman.
It is a funny old man voice.
It is. There's a lot of neon in this world as well. News on TV behind the bar is about the terrorist attack on the SHIELD. A group calling themselves Cobalt, led by Louise Marcus. Connor McLeod looks up and he goes, oh, pretty girl! In his own mind. Oh, God. And then It's a Kind of Magic plays as Virginia Madison gets changed in an alleyway. She's got a note that says, Connor McLeod's going to be down the pub. Go to the pub. She gets changed, to use a wrestling term, into her street clothes.
Yes.
Back in the bar, a drunk old lady has a go at Connor McLeod for covering the world in a big shield. Smashes a bottle over his hand. She gets chucked out into the street.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you start a fight in a bar, you get chucked out.
Yeah, that's it. Fair enough. She's dressed up. She's really pissed. And she's like, I work all day and my life sucks and it's all your fault, you old bastard! And then chucks a bottle at him.
Do we think she's as pissed up as pissed up Maureen from Slugs?
No, because she was a mess, Mark. She put Slugs in a salad.
She did.
She couldn't even see. She couldn't even see those juicy slugs in that lettuce. Pissed as a fart.
Fucking pissed up Maureen.
Pissed up Maureen. Connor McLeod leaves the pub, and then Louise bumps into old man Connor McLeod, and she introduces herself. Terror is a dangerous business, Miss Marcus. I just seen you on the news. And he tells her to do one. He's like, do one. Not interested. I'm an old man. I've seen too many things. I'm bored, if anything. She says, I used to look up to you. Now you're nothing but a tired old man. More than you know. And his old man voice. The world is dying, McLeod, and I need your help. Flashback to Planet Zeist. Michael Ironside is sending two porcupine street punk people to go and find Connor McLeod.
These two, right, I really liked. They were just fun, pulpy, sci-fi street punk goons. I thought they were nice as a concept, a kind of just generic but quite interesting street punk. So that just... Love art. I was enjoying the film, so I gave that a love art. I like their outfits. I did like their outfits.
Their outfits, yeah. They're like steampunk porcupine people.
Yeah, what I will say is that this scene did gain 5 quickfire love hearts. So they'll be coming. They'll be coming, Malachi.
I thought of you whilst watching this. I was thinking, he's going to be going batshit crazy watching this because of everything that happens. But yeah, the street punk porcupine people get sent to Earth, and as Mark says, they have got trademark street punk traits, one of which being the maniacal street punk laugh.
Faux show.
They do that. When they enter the Earth's atmosphere, Connor McLeod feels the quickening. Louise says, you all right? What's the matter? McLeod stops the car because they're in a car at this point. The porcupine people are here, Mark. McLeod, you're going to die. They get out the car and he hides Louise in a big bin. He says, get in that bin. I'm going to fight these people. She says, who are they? He says, I ain't got a clue. I've lost my memory. I'm going to fight them though. I can remember I'm good at fighting. Get in the bin. This is where we get the hoverboard chase scene and the shootout with old man McLeod. They're flying around on hoverboards shooting at him, and he's like deflecting their blasts, and he says, Ramirez! Ramirez! Ramirez, my old friend! He exclaims, old man McLeod, as he's getting battered by porcupine people.
So the hoverboards earn a love heart because, you know, fucking hoverboards. Do you remember the scene with hoverboards in He-Man and the Masters of the Universe?
Mate, I do, and that is exactly what I wrote down. It's the same, isn't it?
Can we do He-Man and the Master of the Universe? Is that tat?
It's been on the list since day one.
Mate, let's get that done. Let us get that
get
done.
Get it done.
Get it done.
Before we get to the He-Man hoverboard fight, we've got a few more events to let you know about, haven't we, Mark? Really, because
yes.
Old Man McLeod is up on a futuristic post-apocalyptic stairway, swashbuckling with one of the baddies, and he's getting battered, to be honest. He's fighting him with a pipe. The other baddie, he's blowing up police cars, cackling insanely. He's punking it off big time down the bottom. While they're swashbuckling, a massive train drives through the set. Yes, a massive steam train drives through the set.
Good.
And they start swashbuckling on top of it. McLeod is getting battered until he pulls the punk off the train. The train runs over his neck, separating his neck from his body, thus resulting in the quickening. It hits McLeod, he screams, and everything explodes. When I say everything explodes, the whole set, like the windows, the cars, the trucks, the neon, gone.
In my notes, I just put much explodium, love heart.
Yeah, everything exploded, and then McLeod's standing there screaming like Michael Jackson. Oh!
Fuck me.
And a fuel tanker with a big pair of lips painted on it rolls towards him, explodes right in front of McLeod. The space punk starts laughing insanely, but out of the flames comes Connor McLeod, and now he's 35 years old.
Exactly.
The another thing that earned a love heart was the firework swords are back. I love the firework swords.
Yeah, there's a lot of sparkly sword fighting in this. Yeah, he picks up a sparkly sword and a winged punk takes flight. It is on like Donkey Kong. McCloud jumps onto the hoverboard and this is where we get the whole He-Man sequence. When they're flying around, it reminded me of Godzilla's films because they're just flying around in a circle. Time to say goodbye, Highlander! Now, how would the space porcupine man know that he's called the Highlander? Lovely little scene of lights here when the street punk says, "Hey buddy, got a light?" to the porcupine man, and he just blows him up. McCloud deflects laser beams from the punk on a wire with his blade into a hot dog stand, because remember, it's the 40s, the 50s, it's the past, but it's the future. It's a fusion of both, but not quite as good as either. Con McCloud's there. He says, "Come on, come on." He wraps his sword round a bit of wire to create, you know, a garrote line, and he holds it up, taking the punk's head as his body slowly flies and crashes towards the wall and explodes again. A second round of space orgasms for Connor McCloud and his spent mark. If he's any more, he'll just be pumping out dust.
For fuck's sake, Malachi.
Ramirez! He screams, and the screams of Ramirez reverberate around the universe. Glencoe, Scotland. Connery appears on stage of a Shakespeare production of Hamlet.
Can I just add something at this point? I really wish that I could shout a dead friend's name and summon him back to life. This kind of hit quite hard. I'm not going to go into why, but it really did hit quite hard that he just goes, "Mate," and his mate's alive again. Wouldn't that be a fucking power? I think I'm only going to be serious for a second, but I think out of all the powers that the Highlander's got, I think that's probably the most important in a weird way.
Well, Mark, it is a kind of magic.
It is.
It is a kind of magic, yeah. Sean Connery appears on stage from being called from the ether. He appears on stage at a production of Hamlet. He's from space, Mark, and the past, so he doesn't know what a play is. And the irony is, he's Scottish. It's a Scottish play, isn't it? Macbeth. Did you notice, Mark, that everyone in the crowd was wearing a tartan waistcoat because it's Scotland?
Brilliant. Is he Scottish? Is he an alien? Is he Egyptian? Is he Spanish? And at the end of it all, when he's asked a question, he says something like that, which actually fucking highlights the retcons.
"He bore me upon his back 1,000 times. Sir, whatever you and your gentleman friend got up to with each other whilst he was alive is certainly none of my business."
Lol, gay.
"What's your fucking game, shithead?" "Connery, shithead? What's a shithead?" And that's not the last time he says that throughout this film. The director is furious, but the Scots, they love Connery, so they do. As he's leaving the stage, he sees himself in the mirror and he checks his neck, and it's as if to say, "Oh, hang on a minute, yeah, I forgot. 500 years ago, the Kurgan cut my head off. I'm rather glad this magic works." And then he walks outside, nearly gets run over by a rubbish van. So much for the horse and cart. I suppose this is the future. I also love the fact that Louise sees Connor McCloud at now age 35. He introduces himself and says, "I'm Connor McCloud of the Clan McCloud, banished from the planet Zeist. I now cannot die." You know, he never said the banished from planet Zeist thing before. But he's that beautiful that she just kisses him immediately and goes home with him.
This whole thing, she knows how old he is. He's literally told her that he is from the whatever the fuck century. So he's, you know, 500 times her age.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'd be intimidated by someone with that amount of knowledge and wisdom, and whether or not I could go with someone who was in their hundreds. It's a hell of an age difference, isn't it?
It is, really. But yeah, he takes her back to his Lovejoy pad and tells her all the Highlander rules, which now make no sense because they've added loads of new ones. And she says, this sounds like a load of bollocks, Connor, if I'm honest. And, he just says, well, let's just say it's a kind of magic. McCloud goes to see his old friend Alan, who he designed the shield with. And Alan can't make a cup of coffee anymore. He's an old, tired man. But look, he looks over at Connor McCloud and he's like, my God, you're 35. You need to tell me the secret. Why are you so beautiful? Also, his accent ain't got any better, has it?
No.
No. See, outside the shield, Mark, the radiation is now normal and livable, but Alan is being held against his will at this evil shield centre by a man called David Blake, and he's played by the fella who's out of Scrubs. He comes into the office, Scrubs comes into the office, and he says, ah, McCloud, I'd forgotten you were alive. McCloud gives him a bit of an immortal joke and says, always, ah! He says, how's the shield business? It must be great taking money off every country in the world. I'm providing a service. I'm keeping the dangerous sun away from all these planets. He says, maybe one day the ozone layer will fix itself outside. He said, yeah, but Connor McCloud, you built this shield to last forever. Connor says, nothing lasts forever. Thus contradicting what he just said about living forever. But don't worry, Mark, because this is where things start to hot up. Because Michael Ironside, if you want a job doing yourself, don't send the Porcupine Men, because they've fucked it. They've both lost their heads. I'm going myself. He flies to Earth and he lands on a subway train. He turns around and he makes an Earth reference, Mark. He says, this doesn't look like Kansas. Do they have the Wizard of Oz on Zeist?
I'm sorry. I always said the scene with the Diva Plava Laguna from The Fifth Element was my favourite scene of all time. In any film ever. But that was closely followed by the opening of The Usual Suspects, where Chow Yun-Fat is the most badass in all of badassery.
Yeah.
There is a new number two. There is a new number two of my all-time favourite fucking scenes in any film ever. And that is the scene with Michael Ironside being the bestest actor I've ever seen on the fucking tram. It was absolutely magnificent.
It is. It
10 love hearts. 10. 10 fucking love hearts. It was great. And I would like to apologise to Chow Yun-Fat, but your badassery is now number 3.
Yeah, he lands and he says, this sure doesn't look like Kansas to me, to a guy. Then he kills him and steals his duster. And then he's walking along the train and he sees a kid and he says, oh, you're a little one, as if they don't have children on planet Zeist. He picks him up. Have you ever wanted to drive a train? Because he knows what a train is. He hijacks the train and he's driving it. It goes 200 miles an hour, 300 miles an hour, 400. Sparks are flying out of the front of the train. Lightning, metal riffs are playing hard. The train's falling apart. The passengers are flying around like they're in zero gravity.
And it's not just that. It's
amazing.
His fucking glee face. His absolute glee face. It is just so good. Metal! Who doesn't want metal? Oh, it's just... I paused it. And that's... I went... Oh, after that scene. And I was like, well, you've paused it now. You might as well rewind it and rewatch it. I rewound it and rewatched it 3 times.
To end the hijack scene, the train crashes through the wall in the main street set that we've seen for the whole of the film. Michael Ironside opens the door and just says, last stop. That's it.
It's magnificent. Oh. It's magnificent.
Brilliant. Obviously, Highlander's wife, Heather, we know she's dead. Bonnie Heather, that was way back when he was still technically a Highlander. His wife that he married at the end of the first one, dead. She's dead. She's dead, obviously.
Dead.
I used to want you to see this, what I'd done, what my work had done, but not anymore. And then Katana, Michael Ironside, appears at the graveside. Don't forget, guys, you cannot fight on holy ground. So he just turns up to slag off his dead wife. Connor McCloud can't do anything about
it. Just sasses him the fuck. I enjoyed it.
He does. And I love the fact that Connor response is, "Something's never changed, Katana. You're still a real jerk." He's just been like bad mouthing his dead wife and he just calls him a jerk.
Yeah, just a jerk. That's okay. Jerk.
Yeah. If you think you're coming back to Zeist, you've got another thing coming, matey boy. He says, "I never planned to. I was going to just sit here, grow old. I'd done this dome thing. All of me wives are dead. Yeah, I'd had enough. I just keep going down the pub. Old ladies chucking bottles at me. Don't want to live forever. Who wants to live forever?" Freddy asked before. "Not me. I don't. And you sending those porcupine people down here, I cut one of their heads off. The quickening made me 35 again, so it's all your fucking fault, Katana. You ruined the lot. You shouldn't have even bothered." Ramirez is fascinated by the future. He's walking around, he's looking at TVs, like in shop windows, and he can't understand why there's a big giant Sean Connery head there. He looks at himself in his same clothes he was wearing when he got his head taken by the Kurgan in the first film, and he's like, "You know what, you're right. I need to go to the oldest gentleman's tailor in Scotland to get myself suited and booted," which he does, and he pays for it with an earring.
I really enjoyed this scene as well. This earns it. I mean, you know, I didn't enjoy it as much as the scene with the tram. It only earned one love heart, but I did enjoy this scene with the tailor as well.
The suit fitting montage is brilliant. He's sitting there smoking cigars, drinking whiskey, getting a powerful suit made for him, and he looks smooth as fuck. A sharp dressed man, as Billy Gibbons used to comment on. The man at the shop says, "Can I get a limo for you, sir?" Connery says, "Limo?" Says, "To get you to the airport." "Airport?" "Yes, because you said you needed to get to New York City, and the best way to get there is to fly." "Fly?" Sean Connery flew from his planet to Earth, and he comes from a planet that is filled with massive spaceships. Why does he know that things fly? On the plane, he's completely foxed by it. He's sat next to a lady who's listening to comedy on a Walkman, who he then begins to sween, putting his smooth moves on, telling her tales of dark-haired ladies from the past that he's been with, like Joan of Arc.
Good. One thing about this scene I wanted to query is, you can film a plane as a plane, because there are planes. Why did they need a CG plane that looked like shit?
The shield's not real. It's a constantly under a crimson dark glow, Mark. There is no sky. Don't. But Louise walks up a spiral staircase to an orchestral version of Who Wants to Live Forever. She's examining Connor's Lovejoy pad, full of antiques and photos of him throughout history, at wars and all that sort of stuff, reading his blood-stained diaries. Katana smashes up a taxi. Katana smashing up the taxi is pretty funny as well. He gets in the back of a taxi. In order to stop the taxi, he slams his sword through the windshield. And then instead of opening the window to have a look, he elbows the window and smashes it.
He's brilliant. He's just brilliant. I just love Michael Ironside's ham. He just has the best time.
He does. He gets out of the car and he smashes up the guy's headlights. By the way, the driver's loving it. He's going, "All right, goddamn, you're crazy. You should get together with my sister." And he smashes the car to bits and pops the tyres with his big sword. Inside the building, there's a big corporate douche meeting going on, and he interrupts the business meeting. "Nobody interrupts this corporation. Ironside has got a plan." He says, "I want to join this corporation. I'm into business now. I've been here 10 minutes. I totally understand it. Where do I sign up? I've had quite enough of you." He's only been there 2 minutes. He's like, I fucking hate you, Ironside. So one of his business douche partners stands up and just starts shooting Ironside. But obviously, he's immortal, still alive. He stands up and he goes, "Yes!" And then he breaks the business douche's neck on the table by putting his fingers in his mouth.
The noises of the neck being broken, they were really, really gruesome. And I think, in a lot of ways, something like this, where it's not like practical effects of a face melting or whatever, I feel like it's almost more graphic in a weird way. It feels more visceral, more something you can... I touched the back of my neck, rubbed the back of my neck when this scene happened. And you know, I'd have laughed at someone's face melting. So I do feel like, in a weird way, that was much more gruesome than some of the explicitly graphic stuff that we've watched in the past. Or am I just being a weirdo?
No, that's true, Mark. There's a lot to be said about sounds. That's the best thing about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is the sound, mate. The star. It's all about creepy sounds. But yeah, you're right. And somebody must have been smashing up some melons for that. Kitana sits down at the desk and he makes himself partner of this company. He says, I'm now partner of this. I love business. And Scrubs asks him, he says, what do you want from us? He turns around and he says, I want the Highlander again. He wouldn't know that he was called the Highlander, would he? He's just Connor McLeod. But in that case, why is he called Connor McLeod when he's on Planet Zeist? Is everyone Scottish up there? Is everyone Scottish on Planet Zeist?
Or are they like Spanish, Egyptian, Scottish?
No, because Ramirez. Oh, God. Anyway, Ramirez arrives at McLeod's Lovejoy pad, dressed sharp as fuck. And he says, greetings, Highlander, you're called. And they're straight into swashbuckling and banter, as if they just left off like they did in the first film. What took you so long? They could have killed me. Don't be ridiculous. And they swashbuckle. After they finish swashbuckling, they have a toast to magic and to Zeist.
However, there is 100% less homoerotic running on the beach.
There's no running of the stag in this one.
No.
The power of the stag. McLeod introduces Louise to Ramirez, and obviously, who's this sexy old man that you've got here? They're catching up on good times, you know. Connor McLeod is explaining the plot of this film to Connery, and he looks bemused. He's probably as confused as the rest of us. He doesn't understand why his head's back on, why he's there. Scotland, bins, neon, never seen it. Fly, limo. Louise comes rushing into the room with the terrible news that Alan has been taken to Max. Max? What's Max? Max isn't a person, though. Max is a death sentence. It's a high security prison, Mark. And he's been shifted off there because he knows the Highlander, you see. The Highlander made the dome. On hearing this news, Ramirez is so angry, he says, your time is now. And there's a big model of a globe surrounded in a glass version of the shield. And he punches it and says, let's go. Let's go rescue Alan. Now, Mark, you mentioned graphics scenes in films earlier, a minute ago. This next scene is fucking ludicrous. So their plan to rescue Alan is this. McLeod and Connery, they get a car, they drive into the prison, right? Into it, and they say, get ready. He says, get ready, Sean Connery. This is gonna hurt. They drive past some armed guards. They get shot so many times. Like, they're like exploding. It's like something from a war film. There's blood all over the place. The car stops. They just slump over dead, full of bullet holes. The guards rush up to the car, open the boot. Louise is hiding in there. She pretends that they took her. She's like, oh my, I'm a damsel in distress. Because they just look like chopped up bits of meat in the car. But the plan has worked. Our heroic trio have got inside. Louise is being tended to by a southern doctor who talks like Foghorn Leghorn. McLeod and Ramirez are on trolleys, on gurneys, covered in a blanket, presumed dead. Well, I think they got shot up with about 100 bullets. The blankets come up. McLeod says 108, actually. 108. They haven't got a mark on them now. No. There's no blood on them. There's no bullet holes. But they have ruined Ramirez's splendid waistcoat.
It is a sad loss. I mourn.
My splendid waistcoat. But it doesn't matter about waistcoats because the rescue is on. The three of them run off and they find Alan in a right old state and he just drops dead as soon as they find him. Kitana and the evil guy from Scrubs are watching all this go on monitors. Kitana at this point says, it's like a high school reunion down there. Again. I mean, they might have high school. Another Earth reference, Mark, from Michael Ironside. But Michael Ironside, he don't care. He's just, he's loving life in this one.
So when the Kurgan made jokes like that, you could understand it because he'd lived on Earth. And also at that point, we thought he was from Earth. But Michael Ironside is literally an alien that landed 5 minutes ago.
Our heroes then get trapped in a they get trapped in a room with a giant fan that's set to just squash them and slice them to bits. This is when Connery steps up. Ramirez has a plan. He gets underneath the fan and he starts talking about the quickening and Scottish magic and stuff like that. A light emerges in his hand and he puts it up and he stops the fan. He puts his sword down underneath the fan and he uses Scottish magic to push the fan back up. Bagpipes triumphantly play and he says, "My time here is over. You must go and find Katana. It will take both of your power to destroy the shield." MacLeod says, "Will I ever see you again?" And he says, "Who knows? Who knows? We know, unfortunately, you will never see him again." But then Ramirez turns into pure Scottish magic, and then the fan explodes. They just run out, and it explodes. But he saves the day by turning into solid quickening magic and destroying a fan.
This film is so fucking weird. It goes from like super sci-fi to not very sci-fi to super sci-fi to not very sci-fi to fucking magic and fantasy to not either of those things. It's all over the place. But I don't care.
Katana has had enough of the guy from Scrubs, so he picks him up and crushes his dick and throws him out the window. And he goes on the roof to wait for Highlander. He just climbs on the roof because he knows that's where a final battle has to take place in a Highlander film.
Of course.
MacLeod, inside the building, is taking all the stormtrooper people out, like Bruce Willis. They're all just dropping like flies because he's really good with a gun. You get your classic final battle setting here. A rainy warehouse. It's a classic, Mark.
Good.
This bit reminded me, you know, you said earlier on about the hoverboard fight reminded you of the He-Man film.
Yeah.
This bit reminded me of the end of Batman from 1989 when he's ascending the church to get to the Joker.
It didn't until you said that.
But MacLeod makes his way up the stairs. He's met at the top of the stairs with what Mark loves about this film. Sparkling swords, hard, hard swashbuckling.
Do enjoy. Enjoy. Yeah. 100% would enjoy again.
Well, don't worry, because we're doing the third one, mate. We're coming. We're coming to that.
Good.
But yeah, they have your typical Highlander showdown on the top of the building. There's also an amazing scene where Connor MacLeod escapes in a lift. The lift falls down. He gets crushed to death at the bottom. More explosions, but then Connor MacLeod comes back to life and his bones all pop back into place and he fixes himself. And they carry on fighting.
I just liked the explodion lift, Earn to Love Art.
It's brilliant. But then the battle moves into the core room of the shield. The swashbuckling continues until Michael Ironside is finally on his knees. Connor MacLeod finally makes that head chop. There can be only one. The quickening. Everything explodes, but it starts to explode. But then Connor stops the quickening mid-flow and he's like, "Hang on a minute. I've got an idea." He walks into the centre of the core, begins the quickening again, it destroys the core, and he's alive. "I knew you could do it, Highlander." And then it ends.
Explodium satellite love art. That's the end of my notes.
That's it. All the satellites explode, and they look up and they see the night sky. They see stars for the first time, and then it just stops, doesn't it? Connor MacLeod saves the day by doing the quickening in the core of the shield, thus turning off the shield, and now we can not bow down to the evil corporation of Scrubs.
So this film was basically the plot of the first Highlander film, with pointless and unnecessary science fiction elements added. And there was a huge drop in the quality of the soundtrack. The retcons, flubs, don't cares, whatever you want to call them, they didn't care. They just changed the whole franchise for no good reason that didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. But I don't care. I loved this film. I had the best time watching this tat. And you made me expect something I would hate
So maybe because it was fun and I enjoyed it and I was in the right mood, maybe I kind of watched it with almost like an enhanced tat-eye.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we did. Me and Fletcher thought you'd hate this one because you loved the first one so much. But as you say, you watch it with tat-eye, it doesn't really matter because it is just bonkers. This is the version that we watched is the original 83-minute version of it, which you can't actually get now unless you want to pay about 50, 60 quid for it, which is ludicrous. Don't do that.
Honestly, though, I think it's both versions that are very difficult to get. You can't get this on Amazon, you can't stream it, you can't pay to rent it. And I got the cheapy DVD version for about 5 or 6 quid second hand. But the Renegade version, that is like 40 quid. So because this film was so fundamentally unloved, it's actually quite difficult to watch. And I don't think it's on YouTube either.
No. The only place, because we said when we wanted to do this, we both just bought these secondhand DVD copies of it from the same place. So, yeah, I think that's it. The only place, the best place to see this is going to be a secondhand DVD copy or the VHS, because this is just a rip of the VHS.
Well, that's true. That's true. And the thing I wanted to very briefly touch on is, you know how we've done Freddy 2 and Freddy 3?
Yeah,
this is just like Freddy 2, Nightmare on Elm Street, in as much as the third film completely ignores it.
Thank you for joining us this week on Super Tap Film Club, and we'll see you next time for our Christmassy Christmas episode about a murderous snowman called Jack Frost.